I look at the man at the door. I think of Uncle Pack heeding what he said. I think of the sign in Eason's office. Smart boy wanted. I don't want to go in that door and pass that exam, for if I do, I'll be a permanent telegram boy with a uniform, then a postman, then a clerk selling stamps for the rest of my life. I'll be in Limerick forever, growing roses with my head dead and my bollocks all dried up. The man at the door says, "You, are you coming in here? Are you going to stand there with your face hanging out?" I want to say to the man, "Kiss my arse." But I still have a few weeks left in the post office and he might report me. I shake my head and walk up the street where a smart boy is wanted. The manager, Mr. McCaffrey, says, "I would like to see a specimen of your handwriting to see in short if you have a decent fist. Sit down there at that table. Write your name and address. And write me a paragraph explaining why you came here for this job and how you propose to rise in the ranks of Eason and Son Limited by dint of perseverance and assiduity, where there is great opportunity in this company for a boy that will keep his eye on the guide on ahead and guard his flanks from the siren call of sin." I write, "Frank McCourt, 4 Little Barrington Street, Limerick City, County Limerick, Ireland. I am applying for this job so that I can rise to the highest ranks of Eason's Limited by dint of perseverance and assiduity, knowing that if I keep my eyes ahead and protect my flanks, I'll be safe from all temptation and a credit to Eason's and Ireland in general." "What's this?" says Mr. McCaffrey. "Do we have here a twisting of the truth?"
"I don't know, Mr. McCaffrey."
"Little Barrington Street? That's a lane. Why are you calling it a street? You live in a lane, not a street."
"They call it a street, Mr. McCaffrey."
"Don't be getting above yourself, boy."
"Oh, I wouldn't, Mr. McCaffrey."
"You live in a lane, and that means you have nowhere to go but up. Do you understand that, McCourt?"
"I do, sir."
"You have to work your way out of the lane, McCourt."
"I do, Mr. McCaffrey."
"You have the cut and jib of a lane boy, McCourt."
"Yes, Mr. McCaffrey."
"You have the look of the lane all over you. All over you from pole to toe cap. Don't try to fool the populace, McCourt. You'd have to rise early in the morning to fool the likes of me."
"Oh, I wouldn't, Mr. McCaffrey."
"Then there's the eyes. Very sore eyes you have there. Can you see?"
"I can, Mr. McCaffrey."
"You can read and write, but can you do addition and subtraction?"
"I can, Mr. McCaffrey."
"Well, I don't know what the policy is on sore eyes. I would have to ring Dublin and see where they stand on sore eyes. But your writing is clear, McCourt, a good fist. We'll take you on pending the decision on the sore eyes. Monday morning, 6:30 at the railway station."
"In the morning?"
"In the morning. We don't give out the bloody morning papers at night, do we?"
"No, Mr. McCaffrey."
"Another thing. We distribute the Irish Times, a Protestant paper, run by the Freemasons in Dublin. We pick it up at the railway station. We count it. We take it to the newsagents. But we don't read it. I don't want to see you reading it. You could lose the faith. And by the look of those eyes, you could lose your sight. Do you hear me, McCourt?"
"I do, Mr. McCaffrey."
"No Irish Times. And when you come in next week, I'll tell you about all the English filth you're not to read in this office. Do you hear me?"
"I do, Mr. McCaffrey."
Mrs. O'Connell has the tight mouth, and she won't look at me. She says to Miss Barry,
"I hear a certain upstart from the lanes walked away from the post office exam. Too good for it, I suppose."
"True for you," says Miss Barry.
"Too good for us, I suppose."
"True for you."
"Do you think he'd ever tell us why he didn't take the exam?"
"Oh, he might," says Miss Barry, "if we went down on our two knees."
I tell her, "I want to go to America, Mrs. O'Connell."
"Did you hear that, Miss Barry?"
"I did indeed, Mrs. O'Connell."
"He spoke.
He did indeed." He will rue the day, Miss Barry. Rue he will, Mrs. O'Connell.
Mrs. O'Connell talks past me to the boys waiting on the bench for the telegrams.
This is Frankie McCourt. He thinks he's too good for the post office.
I don't think that, Mrs. O'Connell.
And who asked you to open your gob, Mr. High and Mighty? Too grand for us, isn't he, boys? He is, Mrs. O'Connell.
And after all we did for him, giving him the telegrams with the good tips, sending him to the country on fine days, taking him back after his disgraceful behaviour with Mr. Harrington, the Englishman, disrespecting the body of poor Mrs. Harrington, stuffing himself with ham sandwiches, getting Fluther drunk on sherry, jumping out the window and destroying every rose bush in sight, coming in here, three sheets to the wind, and who knows what else he did delivering telegrams for 2 years? Who knows indeed, though we have a good idea, don't we, Miss Barry?
We do, Mrs. O'Connell, though 'twouldn't be a fit subject to be talking about.
Mrs. O'Connell whispers to Miss Barry, and they look at me and shake their heads.
A disgrace he is to Ireland and his poor mother. I hope she never finds out. But what would you expect of one born in America and his father from the north? We put up with all that and still took him back.
She keeps talking past me again to the boys on the bench.
Going to work for Easons he is, working for that pack of Freemasons and Protestants above in Dublin. Too good for the post office, but ready and willing to deliver all kinds of filthy English magazines all over Limerick. Every magazine he touches will be a mortal sin, but he's leaving now, so he is, and a sorry day it is for his poor mother that prayed for a son with a pension to take care of her in her latter days. So here, take your wages and go from the sight of us. Miss Barry says,
he's a bad boy, isn't he, boys?
He is, Miss Barry.
I don't know what to say. I don't know what I did wrong. Should I say I'm sorry? Goodbye? I lay my belt and pouch on Mrs. O'Connell's desk. She glares at me.
Go on. Go on to your job at Easons. Go from us. Next boy, come up for your telegrams.
They're back at work. And I'm down the stairs to the next part of my life. I don't know why Mrs. O'Connell had to shame me before the whole world. And I don't think I'm too good for the post office or anything else. How could I? With my hair sticking up, pimples dotting my face, my eyes red and oozing yellow, my teeth crumbling with the rot, no shoulders, no flesh in my arse after cycling 13,000 miles to deliver 20,000 telegrams to every door in Limerick and regions beyond. Mrs. O'Connell said a long time ago she knew everything about every telegram boy. She must know about the times I went at myself on top of carrier gunwale, milkmaids gawking, little boys looking up. She must know about Teresa Carmody in the green sofa, how I got her into a state of sin and sent her to hell, the worst sin of all, worse than Carrigogunnel 1,000 times. She must know I never went to confession after Teresa, that I'm doomed to hell myself. A person that commits a sin like that is never too good for the post office or anything else. The barman at South's remembers me from the time I sat with Mr. Hannon, Bill Galvin, Uncle Pat Keating, Black, White, Black. He remembers my father, how he spent his wages and his dole while singing patriotic songs and making speeches from the dock like a condemned rebel.
"And what is it you'd like?" says the barman.
"I'm here to meet Uncle Pat Keating and have my first pint."
"Oh, begod, is that a fact? He'll be here in a minute. And sure there's no reason why I shouldn't draw his pint. And maybe draw your first pint, is there now?"
"There isn't, sir." Uncle Pa comes in and tells me sit next to him against the wall. The barman brings the pints. Uncle Pa pays, lifts his glass, tells the men in the pub.
"This is my nephew Frankie McCourt, son of Angela Sheehan, the sister of my wife, having his first pint. Here's to your health and long life, Frankie. May you live to enjoy the pint, but not too much."
The men lift their pints, nod, drink, and there are creamy lines on their lips and moustaches. I take a great gulp of my pint, and Uncle Pat tells me, "Slow down, for the love of Jesus. Don't drink it all. There's more where that came from, as long as the Guinness family stays strong and healthy." I tell him I want to stand him a pint with my last wages from the post office, but he says, "No, take the money home to your mother, and you can stand me a pint when you come home from America, flush with success and the heat from a blonde hanging on your arm." The men in the pub are talking about the terrible state of the world and how in God's name Hermann Göring escaped the hangman an hour before the hanging. The Yanks are over there in Nuremberg declaring they don't know how the Nazi bastard hid that pill. Was it in his ear? Up his nostril? Up his arse? Surely the Yanks looked in every hole and cranny of every Nazi they captured, and still Hermann wiped their eye. There you are. It shows you can sail across the Atlantic, land in Normandy, bomb Germany off the face of the earth, but when all's said and done, they can't find a little pill planted in the far reaches of Göring's fat arse. Uncle Pa buys me another pint. It's harder to drink because it fills me and makes my belly bulge. The men are talking about concentration camps and the poor Jews that never harmed a soul, men, women, children, crammed into ovens. Children, mind you. What harm could they do? Little shoes scattered everywhere, crammed in, and the pub is misty and the voices fading in and out. Uncle Pa says, "Are you all right? You're as white as a sheet." He takes me to the lavatory, and the two of us have a good long piss against the wall, which keeps moving back and forth. I can't go into the pub again. Cigarette smoke, stale Guinness, Göring's fat arse, small shoes scattered. Can't go in again. "Good night, Uncle Pa. Thanks." And he tells me, "Go straight home to my mother, straight home." Oh, he doesn't know about the excitement in the loft, or the excitement on the green sofa, or me in such a state of doom that if I died now, I'd be in hell in a wink. Uncle Pa goes back to his pint. I'm out on O'Connell Street, and why shouldn't I take the few steps to the Jesuits and tell all my sins this last night I'll be 15? I ring the bell at the priest's house, and a big man answers, "Yes?" I tell him I want to go to confession, Father. He says, "I'm not a priest. Don't call me Father. I'm a brother." "All right, brother. I want to go to confession before I'm 16 tomorrow. State of grace on my birthday." He says, "Go away. You're drunk. Child like you, drunk as a lord, ringing for a priest at this hour. Go away or I'd call the guards."
I don't. I only want to go to confession. I'm doomed."
"You're drunk, and you're not in a proper spirit of repentance." He closes the door in my face. Another door closed in the face, but I'm 16 tomorrow, and I ring again. The brother opens the door, swings me around, kicks my arse, and sends me tripping down the steps. He says, "Ring this bell again, and I'll break your hand." Jesuit brothers are not supposed to talk like that. They're supposed to be like our Lord, not walk in the world threatening people's hands. I'm dizzy. I'll go home to bed. I hold on to railings along Barrington Street and keep to the wall going down the lane. Mam is by the fire smoking a woodbine. My brother's upstairs in the bed. She says, "That's a nice state to come home in." It's hard to talk, but I tell her I had my first pint with Uncle Pa. No father to get me the first pint. "Your Uncle Pa should know better." I stagger to a chair and she says, "Just like your father." I try to control the way my tongue moves in my mouth. I'd rather be like my father than Lemon Griffin. She turns away from me and looks into the ashes in the range. But I won't leave her alone because I had my pint, 2 pints, and I'm 16 tomorrow, a man. "Did you hear me? I'd rather be like my father than Lemon Griffin." She stands up and faces me. "Mind your tongue," she says. "Mind your own bloody tongue. Don't talk to me like that. I'm your mother. I'll talk to you any bloody way I like. You have a mouth like a messenger boy." "Do I? Do I?
Well, I'd rather be a messenger boy than the likes of Lemon Griffin, old drunkard with a snotty nose in his loft, and people climbing up there with him.
She walks away from me, and I follow her upstairs to the small room. She turns.
Leave me alone, leave me alone.
And I keep barking at her, Lemon Griffin, Lemon Griffin, till she pushes me.
Get out of this room!
And I slap her on the cheek so the tears jump in her eyes and there's a small whimpering sound from her.
You'll never have the chance to do that again.
And I back away from her because there's another sin on my long list. And I'm ashamed of myself. I fall into my bed, clothes and all, and wake up in the middle of the night puking on my pillow. My brother's complaining of the stink, telling me, clean up, I'm a disgrace. I hear my mother crying and I want to tell her I'm sorry. But why should I after what she did with Lemon Griffin? In the morning, my small brothers are gone to school. Malachi is out looking for a job. Mam is at the fire drinking tea. I place my wages on the table by her elbow and turn to go. She says, do you want a cup of tea?
No.
'Tis your birthday.
I don't care.
She calls up the lane after me.
You should have something in your stomach.
But I give her my back and turn the corner without answering. I still want to tell her I'm sorry, but if I do, I'll want to tell her she's the cause of it all. That she should not have climbed to the loft that night, and I don't give a fiddler's fart anyway because I'm still writing threatening letters for Mrs. Finucane and saving to go to America. I have the whole day before I go to Mrs. Finucane to write the threatening letters. And I wander down Henry Street till the rain drives me into the Franciscan church, where St. Francis stands with his birds and lambs. I look at him and wonder why I ever prayed to him. No, I didn't pray. I begged. I begged him to intercede for Teresa Carmody, but he never did a thing, stood up there on his pedestal with a little smile, the birds, the lambs, and didn't give a fiddler's fart about Teresa or me. I'm finished with you, St. Francis. Moving on. Francis. I don't know why they ever gave me that name. I'd be better off if they called me Malachi, one a king, the other a great saint.
Why didn't you heal Teresa? Why did you let her go to hell? You let my mother climb to the loft. You let me get into a state of doom. Little children's shoes scattered in concentration camps. I have the abscess again. It's in my chest and I'm hungry.
St. Francis is no help. He won't stop the tears bursting out of my two eyes, the sniffling and the choking, and the God of gods that have me on my knees, with my head in the back of the pew before me, and I'm so weak with the hunger and the crying, I could fall on the floor. And would you please help me, God or St. Francis, because I'm 16 today, and I hit my mother and sent Teresa to hell, and wanked all over Limerick and the county beyond, and I dread the millstone around my neck. There's an arm around my shoulders, a brown robe, click of black rosary beads, a Franciscan priest. My child, my child, my child. I'm a child and I lean against him, little Frankie on his father's lap. Tell me all about Cahool and Dad, my story that Malachi can't have or Freddie Leibowitz on the swings. My child, sit here with me. Tell me what troubles you, only if you want to. I'm Father Gregory.
I'm 16 today, Father.
Oh, lovely, lovely. And why should that be a trouble to you?
I drank my first pint last night.
Yes?
I hit my mother.
God help us, my child. But he'll forgive you. Is there anything else?
I can't tell you, Father.
Would you like to go to confession?
I can't, Father. I did terrible things.
God forgives all who repent. He sent his only beloved son to die for us.
I can't tell, Father. I can't.
But you could tell St. Francis, couldn't you?
He doesn't help me anymore.
But you love him, don't you?
I do. My name is Francis.
Then tell him. We'll sit here and you'll tell him the things that trouble you. If I sit and listen, it will only be a pair of ears for St. Francis and our Lord. Won't that help? I talk to St. Francis and tell him about Margaret, Oliver, Eugene. My father singing Roddy McCauley and bringing home no money. My father sending no money from England. Teresa and the green sofa. My terrible sins on Carrigagunnell. Why couldn't they hang Hermann Göring for what he did to the little children with shoes scattered around concentration camps? The Christian brother who closed the door in my face. The time they wouldn't let me be an altar boy. My small brother Michael walking up the lane with the broken shoe, clacking. My bad eyes that I'm ashamed of. The Jesuit brother who closed the door in my face. The tears in Mam's eyes when I slapped her. Father Gregory says, "Would you like to sit and be silent, perhaps pray for a few minutes?" His brown robe is rough against my cheek, and there's a smell of soap. He looks at St. Francis and the tabernacle and nods, and I suppose he's talking to God. Then he tells me kneel, gives me absolution, tells me say 3 Hail Marys, 3 Our Fathers, 3 Glory Bees. He tells me God forgives me, and I must forgive myself, that God loves me, and I must love myself, for only when you love God in yourself can you love all God's creatures. But I want to know about Teresa Carmody in hell, Father. No, my child. She is surely in heaven. She suffered like the martyrs in olden times, and God knows that's penance enough. You can be sure the sisters in the hospital didn't let her die without a priest. Are you sure, Father? I am, my child. He blesses me again, asks me to pray for him, and I'm happy trotting through the rainy streets of Limerick, knowing Teresa is in heaven with a cough. Gone. Monday morning, and it's dawn in the railway station. Newspapers and magazines are piled in bundles along the platform wall. Mr. McCaffrey is there with another boy, Willie Harold, cutting the twine on the bundles, counting, entering the count in a ledger. English newspapers and the Irish Times have to be delivered early. Magazines later in the morning. We count out the papers and label them for delivery to shops around the city. Mr. McCaffrey drives the van and stays at the wheel while Willie and I run into shops with bundles and take orders for the next day, add or drop in the ledger. After the papers are delivered, we unload the magazines at the office and go home to breakfast for 50 minutes. When I return to the office, there are two other boys, Eamon and Peter, already sorting magazines, counting and stuffing them into newsagents' boxes along the wall. Small orders are delivered by Jerry Halvey on his messenger bicycle, big orders in the van. Mr. McCaffrey tells me stay in the office so that I can learn to count magazines and enter them in the ledger. The minute Mr. McCaffrey leaves, Eamon and Peter pull out a drawer where they hide cigarette butts and light up. They can't believe I don't smoke. They want to know if there's something wrong with me, the bad eyes, or the consumption, maybe. How can you go out with a girl if you don't smoke? Peter says, wouldn't you be right idiot if you were going out the road with a girl and she asked you for a fag and you say you didn't smoke? Wouldn't you be a right idiot then? How would you ever get her into a field for a bit of a feel? Eamon says, 'tis what my father says about men who don't drink. They're not to be trusted. Peter says, if you find a man that won't drink or smoke, that's a man that's not even interested in girls, and you'd want to keep your hand over the whole of your arse. That's what you'd want to be doing. They laugh, and that brings on the cough. And the more they laugh, the more they cough, till they're holding on to one another, banging one another between the shoulder blades and wiping tears from their cheeks. When the fit passes, we pick out English and American magazines and look at the advertisements for women's underwear, brassieres and panties and long nylon stockings. Eamon is looking at an American magazine called C, with pictures of Japanese girls who keep the soldiers happy so far away from home. And Eamon says he has to go to the lavatory, and when he does, Peter gives me a wink. You know what he's doing in there, don't you? And sometimes Mr. McCaffrey gets into a state when boys linger in the lavatory, interfering with themselves and wasting the valuable time for which Easons is paying them, and on top of it, putting their immortal souls in danger. Mr. McCaffrey won't come right out and say, stop that wanking, because you can't accuse someone of a mortal sin unless you have proof. Sometimes he goes snooping in the lavatory when a boy comes out. He comes back himself with a threatening look and tells the boys, "Ye are not to be looking at those dirty magazines from foreign parts. Ye are to count them and put them in the boxes, and that's all." Eamon comes back from the lavatory, and Peter goes in with an American magazine, Collier's, that has pictures of girls in a beauty contest. Eamon says, "Do you know what he's doing in there? At himself. 5 times a day he goes in. Every time a new American magazine comes in with the women's underwear, he goes in. Never done going at himself. Borrows magazines to take home unbeknownst to Mr. McCaffrey. And God knows what he does with himself in the magazines all night. If he fell dead in there, the jaws of hell would open wide." I'd like to get into the lavatory myself when Peter comes out, but I don't want them saying, "There he goes, new boy, first day in the job, already at himself. Won't light up a fag, oh no, but wanks away like an old billy goat." Mr. McCaffrey returns from van delivery and wants to know why all the magazines aren't counted out, bundled and ready to go. Peter tells him, "We were busy teaching the new boy McCourt. God help us, he was a bit slow with the bad eyes, you know, but we kept at him and now he's getting faster." Jerry Halvey, the messenger boy, won't be in for a week because he's entitled to his holidays and he wants to spend the time with his girlfriend Rose, who's coming back from England. "I'm the new boy, and I have to be the messenger boy while he's gone, cycling around Limerick on the bicycle with the big metal basket in front. He shows me how to balance papers and magazines so that the bicycle won't tip over with me in the saddle and a lorry passing by that will run over me and leave me like a piece of salmon in the road. He saw a soldier once that was run over by an army lorry. That's what he looked like, salmon." Jerry is making a last delivery at Easton's kiosk at the railway station at noon on Saturday, and that's handy, because I can meet him there to get the bicycle, and he can meet Rose off the train. We stand at the gate waiting, and he tells me he hasn't seen Rose in a year. She's over there working in a pub in Bristol, and he doesn't like that one bit because the English are forever pawing the Irish girls, hands up under the skirts and worse, and the Irish girls are afraid to say anything for fear of losing their jobs. Everyone knows Irish girls keep themselves pure, especially Limerick girls, known the world over for their purity, who have a man to come back to like Jerry Halvey himself. He'll be able to tell if she was true to him by her walk. If a girl comes back after a year with a certain class of a walk that's different from the one she went away with, then you know she was up to no good with the Englishmen, dirty, horny bastards that they are. The train hoots into the station, and Jerry waves and points to Rose coming towards us from the far end of the train. Rose smiling away with her white teeth and lovely in a green dress. Jerry stops waving and mutters under his breath, "Look at the walk and her, bitch, whore, streetwalker, flaghopper, trollop," and runs from the station. Rose walks up to me. "Was that Jerry Halvey you were standing with?" "'Twas." "Where is he?" "Oh, he went out." "I know he went out. Where did he go?" "I don't know. He didn't tell me. He just ran out." "Didn't say anything?" "I didn't hear him say anything." "Do you work with him?" "I do. I'm taking over the bike." "What bike?" "The messenger bike." "Is he on a messenger bike?" "He is. He told me he worked in Easton's office. Clerk. Inside job." I feel desperate. I don't want to make a liar of Jerry Halvey to get him into trouble with the lovely Rose. "Oh, we all take turns on the messenger bike. An hour in the office, an hour in the bike. The manager said 'tis good to get out in the fresh air." "Well, I'll just go home and put my suitcase down and go to his house. I thought he'd carry this for me. I have the bike here, and you could stick the case in the basket and I'll walk you home." We walk up to her house in Carey's Road, and she tells me she's so excited about Jerry. She saved her money in England, and now she wants to go back with him and get married, even if he's only 19 and she's only 17. What matter when you're in love? I live like a nun in England and dreamt of him every night, and thank you very much for carrying my case. I turn away to jump on the bike and cycle back to Eason's, when Jerry comes at me from behind. His face is red and he's snorting like a bull. "What were you doing with my girl, you little shite, eh? What? If 'tis a thing I ever find out you did anything with my girl, I'd kill you."
"I didn't do anything. Carried her case because 'twas heavy."
"Don't look at her again or you're dead."
"I won't, Jerry. I don't want to look at her."
"Oh, is that a fact? Is she ugly or what?"
"No, no, Jerry. She's yours and she loves you."
"How do you know?"
"She told me."
"She did?"
"She did. Honest to God."
"Jesus!" He bangs on her door. "Rose! Rose, are you there?"
And she comes out. "Of course I'm here."
And I ride away on the messenger bicycle with the sign in the basket that says Eason's, wondering about the way he's kissing her now, and the terrible things he said about her in the station, and wondering how Peter in the office could tell Mr. McCaffrey a barefaced lie about me and my eyes, when all the time he and Eamon were looking at girls in their underwear and then going at themselves in the lavatory. Mr. McCaffrey is in a terrible state in the office. "Where were you? Great God above in heaven, does it take you all day to cycle from the railway station? We have an emergency here, and we should have Halvey, but he's gone off on his friggin' holidays, God forgive the language, and you'll have to cycle around as fast as you can. Good thing you were a telegram boy that knows every inch of Limerick, and go to every bloody shop that's a customer and walk right in. Grab whatever copies you see of John of London's Weekly, tear out page 16, and if anyone bothers you, tell them 'tis government orders and they're not to interfere in government business. And if they lay a finger on you, they're liable to arrest, imprisonment and a large fine. Now go for God's sake and bring back every page 16 you tear out so we can burn them there in the fire."
"Every shop, Mr. McCaffrey?"
"I'll do the big ones, you do the small ones all the way to Ballinacorra and out the Innes Road and beyond, God help us. Go on, go." I'm jumping on the bike and Eamon runs down the steps. "Hey, McCourt, wait, listen. Don't give him all the page 16s when you come back."
"Why?"
"We can sell him, me and Peter."
"Why?"
"'Tis all about birth control and that's banned in Ireland."
"What's birth control?"
"Oh, Christ above, don't you know anything? 'Tis condoms, you know, rubbers, French leathers, things like that to stop the girls from getting up the pole."
"Up the pole?"
"Pregnant! 16 years of age and you're pure ignorant. Hurry up and get the pages before everybody starts running to the shop for John of London's Weekly."
I'm about to push away on the bike when Mr. McCaffrey runs down the steps.
"Hold on, McCourt, we'll go in the van. Eamon, you come with us."
"What about Peter?"
"Leave him. He'll wind up with a magazine in the lavatory anyway."
Mr. McCaffrey talks to himself in the van.
"Nice bloody how do you do, ringing down here from Dublin on a fine Saturday to send us tearing around Limerick, ripping pages out of an English magazine, when I could be at home with a cup of tea and a nice bun and a read of the Irish Press, with my feet up on a box under the picture of the Sacred Heart. Nice bloody how do you do entirely." Mr. McCaffrey runs into every shop with us behind him. He grabs the magazines, hands each of us a pile and tells us, "Start tearing." Shop owners scream at him, "What are you doing? Jesus, Mary and Holy St. Joseph, is it pure magia? Put back the magazines or I'll call the guards." Mr. McCaffrey tells them, "Government orders, man. There is filth in John of London this week that's not fit for any Irish eyes and we are here to do God's work."
"What filth? What filth? Show me the filth before you go mutilating the magazines. I won't pay Eason's for these magazines, so I won't."
"Ma'am, we don't care at Eason's. We'd rather lose large amounts than have the people of Limerick and Ireland corrupted by this filth."
"What filth?"
"Can't tell you. Come on, boys." We throw the pages on the floor of the van, and when Mr. McCaffrey is in a shop arguing, we stuff some into our shirts. There are old magazines in the van, and we tear and scatter them so that Mr. McCaffrey would think they're all page 16 from John of London. The biggest customer for the magazine, Mr. Hutchinson, tells Mr. McCaffrey, "Get the hell out of his shop or he'll brain him. Get away from them magazines." And when Mr. McCaffrey keeps on tearing out pages, Mr. Hutchinson throws him into the street, Mr. McCaffrey yelling that this is a Catholic country, and just because Hutchinson is a Protestant, that doesn't give him the right to sell filth in the holiest city of Ireland. Mr. Hutchinson says, "Ah, kiss my arse." And Mr. McCaffrey says, "See, boys? See what happens when you're not a member of the true church?" Some shops say they've already sold their copies of John of London, and Mr. McCaffrey says, "Oh, Mother of God, what's going to become of us all? Who did ye sell them to?" He demands the names and address of the customers who are in danger of losing their immortal souls from reading articles on birth control. He will go to their houses and rip out that filthy page, but the shopkeepers say, "'Tis Saturday night, McCaffrey, and getting dark, and would you ever take a good running jump for yourself?" On the way back to the office, Eamon whispers to me in the back of the van, "'I have 21 pages. How many do you have?' I tell him 14, but I have over 40, and I'm not telling him because you never have to tell the truth to people who lie about your bad eyes. Mr. McCaffrey tells us, "'Bring in the pages from the van.' We scoop up everything on the floor, and he's happy sitting at his desk at the other end of the office, ringing Dublin, to tell them how he stormed through shops like God's Avenger and saved Limerick from the horrors of birth control while he watches a dancing fire of pages that have nothing to do with John of London's Weekly. Monday morning I cycle through the streets delivering magazines, and people see the Easton sign on the bike, and stop me to see if there's any chance they could get their hands on a copy of John of London's Weekly. They're all rich-looking people, some in motor cars, men with hats, collars and ties, and two fountain pens in their pockets, women with hats and little bits of fur dangling from their shoulders, people who have tea at the Savoy or the Stella and stick out their little fingers to show how well-bred they are, and now want to read this page about birth control. Eamon told me early in the day, "Don't sell the bloody page for less than 5 shillings." I asked him if he was joking. No, he wasn't. Everyone in Limerick is talking about this page and they're dying to get their hands in it. 5 shillings are nothing, Frankie. If they're rich, charge more. But that's what I'm charging, so don't be going around on your bicycle and putting me out of business with low prices. We have to give Peter something or he'll be running to McCaffrey and spilling the beans. Some people are willing to pay 7 shillings and sixpence, and I'm rich in 2 days, with over £10 in my pocket, minus one for Peter the Snake, who would betray us to McCaffrey. I put £8 in the post office for my fare to America, and that night we have a big supper of ham, tomatoes, bread, butter, jam. Mam wants to know if I won the sweepstakes, and I tell her people give me tips. She's not happy I'm a messenger boy, because that's the lowest you can drop in Limerick, but if it brings in ham like this, we should light a candle in gratitude. She doesn't know the money for my fare is growing in the post office, and she'd die if she knew what I was earning from writing threatening letters. Malachy has a new job in the stockroom of a garage, handing out parts to mechanics, and Mam herself is taking care of an old man, Mr. Sliney, out in the South Circular Road, while his 2 daughters go off to work every day. She tells me, if I'm delivering papers out there, to come to the house for tea and a sandwich. The daughters will never know, and the old man won't mind because he's only half-conscious most of the time, worn out from all his years in the English army in India. She looks peaceful in the kitchen of this house in her spotless apron, everything clean and polished around her, flowers bobbing in the garden beyond, birds chirping away, music from radio airing on the wireless. She sits at the table with a pot of tea, cups and saucers, plenty of bread, butter, cold meats of all kinds. I can have any class of a sandwich, but all I know is ham and brawn. She doesn't have any brawn, because that's the kind of thing you'd find people eating in lanes, not in a house in the South Circular Road. She says the rich won't eat brawn because it's what they scoop off floors and counters in bacon factories, and you never know what you're getting. The rich are very particular about what they stick between 2 slices of bread. Over in America, brawn is called head cheese, and she doesn't know why. She gives me a ham sandwich with juicy slices of tomato, and tea in a cup with little pink angels flying around shooting arrows at other little flying angels who are blue. And I wonder why they can't make teacups and chamber pots without all kinds of angels and maidens cavorting in the glen. Mam says that's the way the rich are. They love the bit of decoration. And wouldn't we, if we had the money? She'd give her two eyes to have a house like this, with flowers and birds abroad in the garden, and the wireless playing that lovely Warsaw Concerto or the Dream of Alwyn, and no end of cups and saucers with angels shooting arrows. She says she has to look in on Mr. Sliney. He's so old and feeble he forgets to call for the chamber pot. Chamber pot? You have to empty his chamber pot? Of course I do. There's a silence here because I think we're remembering the cause of all our troubles, Lemon Griffin's chamber pot. But that was a long time ago. And now it's Mr. Sliney's chamber pot, which is no harm, because she's paid for this and he's harmless. When she comes back, she tells me Mr. Sliney would like to see me, so come in while he's awake. He's lying in a bed in the front parlour, the window blocked with a black sheet, no sign of light. He tells my mother,
"Lift me up a bit, missus, and pull back that bloody thing off the window so I can see the boy."
He has long white hair down to his shoulders. Mam whispers he won't let anyone cut it. He says,
"I have me own teeth, son. Would you credit that? Do you have your own teeth, son?"
"I do, Mr. Sliney."
"Ah, I was in India, you know. Me and Timony up the road. Bunch of Limerick men in India. Do you know Timony, son?"
"I did, Mr. Sliney."
"He's dead, you know. Poor bugger went blind. I have me sight. I have me teeth. Keep your teeth, son."
"I will, Mr. Sliney."
"I'm getting tired, son. But there's one thing I want to tell you. Are you listening to me?"
"I am, Mr. Sliney."
"Is he listening to me, missus?"
"Oh, he is, Mr. Sliney."
"Good. Now here's what I want to tell you. Lean over here so I can whisper in your ear. What I want to tell you is, never smoke another man's pipe."
Halvey goes off to England with Rose, and I have to stay on the messenger bike all through the winter. It's a bitter winter, ice everywhere, and I never know when the bike will go out from under me and send me flying into the street or onto the pavement, magazines and paper scattered. Shops complain to Mr. McCaffrey that the Irish Times is coming in decorated with bits of ice and dog shit, and he mutters to us, "That's the way that paper should be delivered, Protestant rag that it is." Every day after my deliveries, I take the Irish Times home and read it to see where the danger is. Mam says it's a good thing Dad isn't here. He'd say, "Is this what the men of Ireland fought and died for, that my own son is sitting there at the kitchen table reading the Freemason paper?" There are letters to the editor from people all over Ireland claiming they heard the first cuckoo of the year, and you can read between the lines that people are calling each other liars. There are reports about Protestant weddings and pictures, and the women always look lovelier than the ones we know in the lanes. You can see Protestant women have perfect teeth, although Halvey's Rose had lovely teeth. I keep reading the Irish Times and wondering if it's an occasion of sin, though I don't care. As long as Teresa Carmody is in heaven, not coughing, I don't go to confession any more. I read the Irish Times and the Times of London because that tells me what the King is up to every day and what Elizabeth and Margaret are doing. I read English women's magazines for all the food articles and the answers to women's questions. Peter and Eamon put on English accents and pretend they're reading from English women's magazines. Peter says,
"Dear Miss Hope, I'm going out with a fella from Ireland named McCaffrey, and he has his hands all over me and his thing pushing against my belly button, and I'm demented not knowing what to do. I remain, yours anxiously, Miss Lulu Smith, Yorkshire." Eamon says, "Dear Lulu, if this McCaffrey is that tall, and that he's pushing his yoke against your belly button,
I suggest you find a smaller man who would slip it between your thighs. Surely you can find a decent short man in Yorkshire.
And dear Miss Hope, I'm 13 years old with black hair and something terrible is happening, and I can't tell anyone, not even my mother. I'm bleeding every few weeks, you know where, and I'm afraid I'll be found out. Miss Agnes Triple, Little Biddle on the Twiddle, Devon.
Dear Agnes, you ought to be congratulated. You are now a woman, and you can get your hair permed because you're having your monthlies. Do not fear your monthlies, for all the English women have them. They are a gift of God to purify us, so that we can have stronger children for the empire, soldiers to keep the Irish in their place. In some parts of the world, a woman with a monthly is unclean, but we British cherish our women with the monthlies. Oh, we do indeed.
In the springtime, there's a new messenger boy, and I'm back in the office. Peter and Eamon drift off to England. Peter is fed up with Limerick. No girls. And you're driven to yourself. Wank, wank, wank. That's all we ever do in Limerick. There are new boys. I'm senior boy, and the job is easier because I'm fast. And when Mr. McCaffrey is out in the van and my work is done, I read the English, Irish, American magazines and papers. Day and night, I dream of America. Maliki goes to England to work in a rich Catholic boys' boarding school, and he walks around cheerful and smiling, as if he's the equal of any boy in the school. And everyone knows when you work in an English boarding school, you're supposed to hang your head and shuffle like a proper Irish servant. They fire him for his ways, and Maliki tells them they can kiss his royal Irish arse, and they say that's the kind of foul language and behaviour you'd expect. He gets a job in the gasworks in Coventry, shoveling coal into the furnaces like Uncle Pa Keating, shoveling coal, and waiting for the day he can go to America after me. I'm 17, 18, going on 19, working away at Eason's, writing threatening letters for Mrs. Finucane, who says she's not long for this world, and the more mass is said for her soul, the better she'll feel. She puts money in envelopes and sends me to churches around the city to knock on priests' doors, hand in the envelopes with a request for masses. She wants prayers from all the priests but the Jesuits. She says, they're useless, all head and no heart. That's what they should have over their door in Latin, and I won't give them a penny because every penny you give a Jesuit goes to a fancy book or a bottle of wine. She sends the money. She hopes the masses are said, but she's never sure. And if she's not sure, why should I be handing out all that money to priests when I need the money to go to America? And if I keep back a few pounds for myself and put it in the post office, who will ever know the difference? And if I say a prayer for Mrs. Finucane and light candles for her soul when she dies, won't God listen, even if I'm a sinner long past my last confession? I'll be 19 in a month. All I need is a few pounds to make up the fare, and a few pounds in my pocket when I land in America. The Friday night before my 19th birthday, Mrs. Finucane sends me for the sherry. When I return, she's dead in the chair, her eyes wide open, and her purse on the floor wide open. I can't look at her, but I help myself to a roll of money. 17 pounds. I take the key to the trunk upstairs. I take 40 of the 100 pounds in the trunk and the ledger. I'll add this to what I have in the post office, and I have enough money to go to America. On my way out, I take the sherry bottle to save it from being wasted. I sit by the River Shannon near the dry docks, sipping Mrs. Finucane's sherry. Aunt Aggie's name is in the ledger. She owes 9 pounds. It might have been the money she spent on my clothes a long time ago, but now she'll never have to pay it because I heave the ledger into the river. I'm sorry I'll never be able to tell Aunt Aggie I saved her 9 pounds. I'm sorry I wrote threatening letters to the poor people in the lanes of Limerick, my own people, but the ledger is gone. No one will ever know what they owe, and they won't have to pay their balances. I wish I could tell them, I'm your Robin Hood. Another sip of the sherry. I'll spare a pound or two for a mass for Mrs. Finucane's soul. Her ledger is well on its way down the Shannon and out to the Atlantic, and I know I'll follow it someday soon. The man at O'Riordan's travel agency says he can't get me to America by air unless I travel to London first, which would cost a fortune. He can put me on a ship called the Irish Oak, which will be leaving Cork in a few weeks. He says, 9 days at sea, September, October, best time of the year, your own cabin, 13 passengers, best of food, bit of a holiday for yourself. And that will cost £55. Do you have it?
I do.
I tell ma'am I'm going in a few weeks, and she cries. Michael says, will we all go someday? We will. Alfie says,
will you send me a cowboy hat and a thing you throw that comes back to you?
Michael tells him that's a boomerang, and you'd have to go all the way to Australia to get the likes of that. You can't get it in America.
Alfie says, you can get it in America. Yes, you can.
And they argue about America and Australia and boomerangs till ma'am says,
for the love of Jesus, your brother is leaving us, and the two of ye are there squabbling over boomerangs. Will you give over?
Ma'am says, we'll have to have a bit of a party the night before I go. They used to have parties in the old days when anyone would go to America, which was so far away the parties were called American Wakes, because the family never expected to see the departing one again in this life. She says 'tis a great pity Maliki can't come back from England, but we'll be together in America some day with the help of God and his blessed mother. On my days off from work, I walk around Limerick and look at all the places we lived, the Windmill Street, Hartstong Street, Roden Lane, Ross Bryan Road, Little Barrington Street, which is really a lane. I stand looking at Teresa Carmody's house till her mother comes out and says, what do you want? I sit at the graves of Oliver and Eugene in the old St. Patrick's burying ground and cross the road to St. Lawrence's Cemetery, where Teresa is buried. Wherever I go, I hear voices of the dead, and I wonder if they can follow you across the Atlantic Ocean. I want to get pictures of Limerick stuck in my head in case I never come back. I sit in St. Joseph's Church and the Redemptorist Church and tell myself, take a good look, because I might never see this again. I walk down Henry Street to say goodbye to St. Francis, though I'm sure I'll be up to talk to him in America. Now there are days I don't want to go to America. I'd like to go to O'Riordan's travel agency and get back my £55. I could wait till I'm 21, and Maliki can go with me so that I'll know at least one person in New York. I have strange feelings, and sometimes when I'm sitting by the fire with Mam and my brothers, I feel tears coming, and I'm ashamed of myself for being weak. At first Mam laughs and tells me, your bladder must be near your eye. But then Michael says, we'll all go to America. Dad will be there, Maliki will be there, and we'll all be together. And she gets the tears herself, and we sit there, the four of us, like weeping agents. Mam says, this is the first time we ever had a party. And isn't it a sad thing altogether that you have it when your children are slipping away one by one, Maliki to England, Frank to America? She saves a few shillings from her wages taking care of Mr. Sliney to buy bread, ham, brawn, cheese, lemonade, and a few bottles of stout. Uncle Pat Keating brings stout, whiskey, and a little sherry for Aunt Aggie's delicate stomach, and she brings a cake loaded with currants and raisins she baked herself. The Abbot brings 6 bottles of stout and says, that's all right, Frankie. You can all drink it as long as I have a bottle or two for myself to help me sing me song. He sings the Road to Rasheen. He holds his stout, closes his eyes, and the song comes out in a high whine. The words make no sense, and everyone wonders why tears are seeping from his shut eyes. Alfie whispers to me, why is he crying over a song that makes no sense? I don't know. The Abbot ends his song, opens his eyes, wipes his cheeks and tells us that was a sad song about an Irish boy that went to America and got shot by gangsters and died before a priest could reach his side. And he tells me, don't be getting shot if you're not near a priest. Uncle Pa says, that's the saddest song he ever heard. And is there any chance we could have something lively? He calls on Mam and she says,
I know, Pa, sure I don't have the wind.
Come on, Angela, come on. One voice now, one voice, and one voice only.
All right, I'll try.
We all join in the chorus of her sad song. A mother's love is a blessing, no matter where you roam. Keep her while you have her, you'll miss her when she's gone.
Uncle Pa says one song is worse than the one before. And are we turning this night into a wake altogether? Is there any chance someone would sing a song to liven up the proceedings? Or will he be driven to drink with the sadness?
Oh God, says Aunt Aggie, I forgot. The moon is having an eclipse abroad this minute.
We stand out in the lane watching the moon disappear behind a round black shadow. Uncle Pa says,
that's a very good sign for you going to America, Frankie.
No, says Aunt Aggie, 'tis a bad sign. I read in the paper that the moon is practicing for the end of the world.
Oh, end of the world, my arse, says Uncle Pa. 'Tis the beginning for Frankie McCourt. He'll come back in a few years with a new suit and fatten his bones like any Yank, and a lovely girl with white teeth hanging from his arm.
Mam says, I know, Pa, I know. And they take her inside and comfort her with a drop of sherry from Spain. It's late in the day when the Irish Oak sails from Cork past Kinsale and Cape Clear, and dark when lights twinkle on Mizzen Head. The last of Ireland I'll see for God knows how long. Surely I should have stayed, taken the post office examination, climbed in the world. I could have brought in enough money from Michael and Alfie to go to school with proper shoes and bellies well filled. We could have moved from the lane to a street or even an avenue where houses have gardens. I should have taken that examination, and Mam would never again have to empty the chamber pots of Mr. Sliney or anyone else. It's too late now. I'm on the ship, and there goes Ireland into the night, and it's foolish to be standing on this deck looking back and thinking of my family and Limerick and Malachy and my father in England. And even more foolish that songs are going through my head, Roddy McCauley goes to die, and Mam gasping all the days of the Kerry dancing, with poor Mr. Clossy hacking away in the bed. And now I want Ireland back. At least I had Mam and my brothers and Aunt Aggie, bad as she was, and Uncle Pa standing me my first pint, and my bladder is near my eye, and here's a priest standing by me on the deck, and you could see he's curious. He's a Limerick man, but he has an American accent from his years in Los Angeles. He knows how it is to leave Ireland, did it himself, and never got over it. You live in Los Angeles with sun and palm trees day in, day out, and you ask God if there's any chance he could give you one soft, rainy Limerick day. The priest sits beside me at the table of the first officer, who tells us ship's orders have been changed, and instead of sailing to New York, we're bound for Montreal. 3 days out, and orders are changed again. We're going to New York, after all. Three American passengers complain. God damn Irish, can't they get it straight? The day before we sail into New York, orders are changed again. We're going to a place up the Hudson River called Albany. The Americans say, Albany? God damn Albany? Why the hell did we have to sail in a god damn Irish tub? God damn! The priest tells me, pay no attention. All Americans are not like that. I'm on deck the dawn we sail into New York. I'm sure I'm in a film, that it will end and lights will come up in the Lyric Cinema.
The priest wants to point out things, but he doesn't have to. I can pick out the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island, the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, the Brooklyn Bridge. There are thousands of cars speeding along the